This is Ridley speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Last year, we had an opportunity to bring a conversation with Amari Victoria and Elizabeth Menning. Both of them are representing the LGBTQ Northwest Indiana organization, and we have them back in studio to talk more about at the time, our conversation was about the inaugural Northwest Indiana Pride program that was going to be underway in Highland. This was this past summer, and we have them back in to bring us an update on that and other things as well, too. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Chris, for having us back.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with the organization, take a few moments and talk a little bit about the organization, how it got started, and get us up to the point where the Pride event got underway last summer.
Thank you, Chris. LGBTQ Northwest Indiana is an organization formed in Northwest Indiana to support the LGBTQ community directly. We have a transgender support group that meets twice a month with plans to expand to a third one in a new location. We also provide education for educators, medical professionals, and suicide prevention and awareness classes.
Now, with all the other events that happened, I guess the organization set up going through 2019, all this time in the background, you all were working hard to get the things lined up for the very first Northwest Indiana Pride event that happened last summer. That happened, by the way, in Highland, at the community center there at the old Franklin's, the old school, what used to be the old school there in the area there in in Highland. How did things go in the organization? Tell people that we couldn't tell us at least what people would have seen if they had been able to be there, and in turn, how things turn out as far as the feedback on is concerned.
Well, the very first NWI Pride Festival held in Highland, like you say, last year on July 13th, was a community success. Nearly 1,000 attendees came and were able to view many different aspects of our community.
Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of entertainment. We had many vendors, about 75 vendors, both products and services, food, drink, local businesses. So that was really well received. And we showcased the support of businesses. We had an educational corner where people could learn more about gender identity and sexual orientation. It was family friendly. It was free, indoors. Oh, good things in the summer.
Yeah, that's right. It was very warm that day too, as I recall. So it was a good thing to have a nice facility, very well air conditioned, especially for that crowd.
Absolutely, yes. Chris. We also had wedding and vow renewals and a corner for poetry reading. We also had a performance by the Queer Youth Theater Ensemble from the Toll Theater in Hammond, as well as live entertainment and drag shows.
Mm-hmm. What kind of feedback or response did you get after the event from folks who attended and were able to enjoy the festivities?
The feedback we received was, in most cases, very positive.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Did you get some suggestions on what to do better for 2020, I suppose?
A few suggestions.
Yeah.
The only suggestion that I can think of that at this moment is that one person asked that we have the festival outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, you may have to find another day for it other than the middle of summer, although the date was well set. It was well attended, I'm sure, because that was a nice day to do it.
Absolutely.
We do have a couple changes planned for this year's event, mm-hmm. Based on feedback we received. One is to have more time for conversation, particularly between the vendors and the attendees. And the other one is that we're taking the after party off-site this time.
Mm-hmm. Did it seem to work out better? Was it you had all the events happening there at the community center, but then you had everything there at the community center, including the after hours party? Did that work out all right? As you say that you're going to go perhaps elsewhere, depending on where you have the 2020 event.
It worked out okay.
Yeah.
We had great attendance at both the daytime event as well as the evening after party. but it made it for a really long day for all the volunteers.
I can imagine. Now, let me ask, you're planning of going into the 2020 Northwest Indiana Pride event that's coming up. Is the are you at the point that you can talk about where it's going to be? Or are you still working these things out right now, though?
Well, actually, we are going to be at the same location.
Oh.
The date has changed. However, we will be having the festival on June 6th, Saturday.
From 11 a.m. to 7 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like I said, the after party's off-site after that.
When you set up an organization, such an event like this, and we talked about this, too, in our first conversation, that there's a lot of work that has to be done behind the scenes and a lot of prep work, as anyone would understand if you have such a community event like that one. But it's especially rough for the very first one. You obviously learned from the problems and the mistakes that you ran into. And do you think that this 2020 event is going to go a little smoother, do you think, in preparation and maybe for the event itself?
Absolutely, Chris. We learned a great deal about running a festival that large, mm-hmm. and we have talked about what needed to change, what we should change, and what improvements we should make to our workflow in order to make setting up of this festival much easier.
You kind of talked about in our start of our conversation about the things that LGBTQ Northwest Indiana does, and the meetings that you have, and the topics you bring up, and as you go into 2020, these the regular meetings, I'm sure, continue on. Are there any others that you are planning to have? You mentioned some things that you would like to do. Do you think this is going to be a year to add more things to the plate, so to speak, or are you finding that you're pretty busy right now?
Well, Chris, there are many things that we would like to do over the course of the next 5 years. But of course, we have to take a bite of that work each year. So yes, there are some opportunities to do some expansion this year by offering the same types of programs that we have in the past, but potentially more of them. And we'll see what next year holds in store for us after that.
I know one of the other organizations, and we haven't mentioned here lately, is that's involved under the umbrella of the organization, the LGBTQ Northwest Indiana, is called PFLAG Crown Point. And Elizabeth, I know that's one of the things in particular that you've worked the hardest on. Mm-hmm. Explain first what PFLAG means and about the organization that you've had and how it's coming along these days.
Okay, thank you, Chris. So PFLAG Crown Point, just one small correction, it's not under the umbrella of LGBTQ Northwest mm-hmm. Indiana. Those are two separate nonprofit organizations. But when Amari came out as transgender and we were looking for support, we realized not only did she need support for her transition, but I needed support as a straight spouse. So we discovered PFLAG and went to Michigan City and Chicago for some great meetings, decided to start a chapter in this area because none existed at the time. And about 6 months after we started the chapter, we decided to put on this Pride Festival that we've been discussing. So last year, PFLAG ran Point and brought in LGBTQ Northwest Indiana. And this year, we're just changing that up a little. We're going to keep PFLAG focused on its mission of providing support, education, and advocacy for families, friends, and members of the community. It was originally started 45 years ago. We're a member of a national chapter. We're a member of a national organization.
Mm-hmm.
And it was designed to mainly provide support for families and friends and allies. But it has since then grown to encompass every aspect of the community members as well.
Did it turn out that this evolution that you talk about from just handling family members, helping support family members to the entire community, was that something that was a pretty apparent right away, or did that just take time as well?
That was actually an evolution in the national organization.
Yeah.
So when we came in June of 2018, we hit the ground running supporting everybody. We have a lot of families, people whose children have made some sort of announcement or come out, as well as people that are struggling with their own identities that have reached out to us for support.
I suppose it's important to note that there are family members out there and young persons in particular that go through the process of deciding to transition in gender and just being involved in the community that people don't know about. It's not a very public affair. There are some public folks that have come out or have become public figures, so to speak, that have come out over time. But most everybody is pretty much just an average person, although they have some very special issues that they're dealing with.
That's what we're finding. We're just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. But the LGBTQ population in Northwest Indiana is still fairly hidden. There's not a lot of social venues for people to hang out. Not everybody wants to go to a bar. Not many of the support groups. There are few organizations that have existed in the past that have helped or tried to help, and there's been a few individuals here and there that we've been talking with. But we're really trying to build up this community and the safe space for people to be their authentic selves.
Is the safe space concept that one of the biggest things that you run into and trying to get the group going and to keep the organization going?
Yes, much of the LGBTQ community, at least in Northwest Indiana, is still under wraps, yeah, in the closet, hiding. And we would love to bring them out, but fear is a factor in many of these people, and we are hoping that we can allay some of that fear by having these meetings and support services, as well as the annual festival.
We're trying to build greater acceptance in the region. And as you know, in Indiana, there's a lot of non-protection for, mm-hmm, LGBTQ people. And that's one reason people are hiding.
Do you find, though, that being so close to Chicago and a little more welcoming atmosphere into the Chicagoland area helps out in this respect, for at least for you here in Northwest Indiana?
I think so. Uh-huh. I think so. One of the big feedbacks, or most prevalent feedback we received from the Pride Festival last year, was people were thrilled that something like this existed in their backyard or their hometown. They were so happy that it was here, and they didn't have to go to Chicago or other places.
I imagine probably, I know in the past there have been some smaller Pride organization events happening. I think some happening around Michigan City mm-hmm, and maybe in Porter County as well, but nothing on a bigger scale like this. And so I can imagine that those events must have gone fairly well, and then that in turn kind of led to saying, well, let's grow and let's see if we can do a larger event. And that's how last year's event in Highland got started.
And just again, Michigan City's event is larger than ours. Mm-hmm. They had about 3,000 people last year, and they were one of the inspirations for us doing our Pride Festival.
Are there any people that have helped out in the organization in Michigan City that have helped work with you to not only to get the first one planned this past year, but helping for 2020?
Absolutely, Chris. One of the planners from the inaugural Michigan City Pride Festival actually joined Elizabeth's PFLAG, mm-hmm, chapter and was a big help to us in getting our first one off the ground.
Mm-hmm. Besides the events that happen on a monthly basis, and by the way, everything is available to find out what and when and where on the website. Besides the regular events and, of course, the annual NWI Pride event that's going to happen in June, again, in Highland this coming summer, are there any other things? You mentioned that you're kind of taking baby steps in some respects and adding things to the mm-hmm, to the list of events and programs and the like. Anything in particular that you'd like to maybe it was on the wish list? You said you've got a five-year-long wish list, apparently.
At least.
Yes, we do. I think one of the things, maybe it'll take longer than 5 years to accomplish, but we would love to have a permanent resource center, community center, to serve the LGBTQ and ally communities.
And on a shorter term basis, we're planning on having a queer prom or some sort of LGBTQ affirming dance social event here. Mm-hmm. And we have also gotten a couple of partnerships with local universities to have interns, and they are helping out quite a bit right now.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Amari, Victoria, and Elizabeth Menning for being with us here in the studio to talk about LGBTQ Northwest Indiana. We're glad to hear that the summertime event last year that happened in Highland, the very first Northwest Indiana Pride event, went well, and you're making the plans for a big or maybe even bigger event for 2020 and all of the other activities in the organization. Thank you for being with us to talk about it today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you, Chris, for having us.
Once again, Amari Victoria is the executive director of LGBTQ Northwest Indiana. Elizabeth Menning is the chief operating officer for the group. And they are also two of the co-chairs for the Northwest Indiana Pride Events Committee. And, of course, the Northwest Indiana Pride event last summer, the very first of its kind here, at least officially, in Northwest Indiana. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. With another edition of Green Fleet Radio, here's Carl Lissick.
Thank you for that introduction. Today our guest is Mr. Adam Theda. He's the Director of Ecological Relations for the Center at Donaldson. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Carl. Appreciate it.
Adam, tell our listeners, what is the Center at Donaldson?
Center at Donaldson is a campus of five different ministries, including a beef and grain farm, a retreat and conference center, nursing home, senior living, an art, earth, and spirituality center, and a college. Hmm. So kind of our flagship institution is Ancilla College, a two-year college in rural Marshall County.
Wonderful. So I know you recently decided to work toward electrifying your fleet. So why did you decide to go to that route?
So the immediate cause was actually a response to one of our guests at the retreat center. He said, I'm bringing my car. Where can I plug in? And we were like, well, we have these kind of 120-volt plugs everywhere on the outside of buildings, so we could kind of make something work or put you in a garage, but we didn't have an answer to that. So then I had some kind of interest in that electrification already, so I went to go look for a grant, got a level 2 charger for electric vehicles that could charge at a much faster rate. So that's the kind of proximate, immediate cause. The larger cause institutionally and from a strategic direction is this much broader challenge of our task as a species now to transition from non-renewable resources to renewable resources like wind and solar. And the prime way that we found that we could do that is electrification. So we have that kind of broad urgency, and we have, as an institution with kind of some focus on social justice and wanting to see that even, you know, the most marginalized peoples have traditionally borne the brunt of our pollution, we have a moral imperative to transition to something better.
Wonderful, wonderful. So what are some of the benefits you're seeing since going electric?
So one of the benefits that we've seen locally is that in the winter when it's 0 degrees and we, you know, expect in our fleet for vehicles to be warm when you're walking outside to people, we don't have to sit there and idle the vehicle and create all that local air pollution. We have a lot of people on our campus that maybe are not in the best of health conditions. And so any extent that we could reduce an additional stress on their body is a good factor. Other benefits we've had are the educational benefits. You know, I have groups from schools and other institutions all the time coming onto campus looking at different features that we've implemented on campus, from rain gardens to the solar arrays to electric vehicles. And that is one more stop kind of on our green tour around campus. So for educational purposes, it's great.
It's wonderful. So what is the connection between electrification and your renewable energy projects?
Yeah, so if we just, you know, put everything on electric and then power that 100% with coal, when you actually do the math, you know, it's not a total net benefit in many ways. So, but we're seeing at the grid level, NIPSCO is rapidly transitioning away from coal, and within 9 years, they'll be done. And locally, we can also accelerate that by deploying renewable energy on site. So we started in 2012 with a small wind turbine, but as you know, the continuing year after year drop in cost made all these other solar projects more feasible. So we've deployed now to date over 600 kilowatts of solar on campus, including about 515 kilowatts at the college. So that's going to cover 75% of the needs over at the college, including if we have charging stations there, people charging in the middle of the day, they're definitely getting 100% of their energy from those solar arrays that are just cranking out.
That is just wonderful. So how are you making the public aware of your electric vehicle charging station?
So we've done kind of some of the traditional press releases, writing on my blog, internal publications. One of the benefits we had of partnering with, we had a grant from the Marshall County Community Foundation that made this possible. Now, if we pinched enough pennies, maybe we could have found a way to do this project on the cheap, but allowing another partner to come in and finance that also had that broader connection to the community that you don't get when you just do a project on your own. You have additional press, you have visits from other people, you have the institutional recognition of those funding partners. So that was a real benefit as well.
So what are some of the next steps that you're looking at reducing emissions at the Center for Donaldson?
So really, our fleet, we have a lot of passenger vehicles, maybe handicap accessible vans. We don't have a lot of the you know, big buses on predictable routes that you would for municipalities, sure. say. So for us, really, electrification from an economic standpoint, environmental, really seems to make the most sense. So we're going to keep pushing ahead, you know, with a fleet of over 50-some vehicles, wow. at various mm-hmm. locations, some of them stationed where we're at, some of them out in the mission. Mm-hmm. We're able to continue every year replacing a couple vehicles in our fleet. And sure. so we're going to keep a really close eye on the opportunities that we have, whether they be fully electric or partially electric, you know, the gas electric plug-in hybrids. Mm-hmm. We've also got one of those for the college. We put a nice wrap on the outside to brand it,
sure.
and with a total kind of go green approach at the college. And that's proved very useful. Now, especially you have to consider the duty cycle, as you know.
Right.
For the college, it's not just these short, predictable routes where we use our Nissan Leaf that's fully electric. That's really good. I drove that here today. Mm-hmm. It was very predictable. At the college, you have recruiting events, sporting events, where they're going to have to go several hours down the road. The charging infrastructure, you know, outside of Tesla is not – it's kind of ad hoc right now. And so for people who are just getting into electric, mm-hmm. that's too much of a jump. Mm-hmm. You know, so we said you got the battery for your first 40 miles of your drive, gas to get you the rest of the way. And we've really found institutionally just getting people – getting rear ends and seats, if you will,
sure.
Is the best way, because it can be so mystifying when you look at you know, the logic of logistics of how to do all that. But if you really just sit down, you got a accelerating pedal, you got a decelerating pedal, you have a steering wheel. Not a lot is different, and people mm-hmm. are surprised at how easy it is once they get behind the wheel.
So how can you tell our listeners more about what the great work that you're actually doing at the center? I mean, it's just fantastic. There's so many initiatives that you got. So how can they learn more about you?
Yeah, so my name is Adam Theta. Mm-hmm. You could look us up at thecenter@donaldson.com and all the different things that we're doing. Actually, at the college, they started a website just to highlight our green initiatives. That is green.ancilla.edu. And you can also look up all the work that we're doing there.
Well, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Adam Theta, Director of Ecological Relations for the Center at Donaldson. Green Fleet Radio airs 3 times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lizick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. A new bill is hoping to help homeowners in Indiana who want solar panels but whose homeowners associations won't allow them. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us that environmental groups around the state have shown support for the measure on this year's Renewable Energy Day.
The bill, authored by Republican Senator Linda Rogers, allows a homeowner to petition their association for the right to put solar panels on their home. If they gather enough signatures of support from their neighbors and meet certain requirements, the association would not be allowed to deny their request. Joey Miles of Franklin Township was only allowed to place solar panels on certain sides of his home after he applied a covering to the panels to make them blend in with the roof.
Which I lose a little bit of efficiency on that.
Democratic Representative Matt Pierce says having solar panels on multiple homes and businesses across the state would make Indiana's electric grid more resilient to outages, including any that could result from a possible cyber attack from Iran. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Indiana College Republicans are joining other young conservatives all across the country in trying to help change the national picture. We are going to find out more about Indiana's role in all of this. Isaiah Mears is the state chairman of the Indiana Federation of College Republicans, and he is also the chairman of Wabash College Republicans, the organization which is on the Wabash College campus down in Crawfordsville. And Isaiah, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris, for having me.
Well, first tell us how the campus Republicans in particular are interested in joining in the conversation.
I guess I can kind of give you a little background on me, too. I mean, this is a conversation that's been being had for quite some time now. This isn't something new. This isn't an issue that is just kind of out there. This is something that's been pretty prominent for the last few years. And one thing that we've kind of discovered as young people is, especially on the conservative side, this isn't something that we're prepared to talk about yet. We haven't developed the right language to be able to kind of combat what the left is saying, and also come up with solutions of our own. And so, being a young conservative, I wanted to kind of take the lead on this and started joining this Young Conservatives for Carbon Dividends Coalition. And this is kind of our way to combat the Green New Deal and our way to kind of develop the language that conservatives need to be able to have these conversations.
I understand that the real goal is to help create a carbon tax. Maybe for folks that are not necessarily familiar with that term, will you explain it from what the coalition has at least passed along to you folks as what they in turn would like to do to help make the changes that are needed?
So a carbon tax would be collected by the Treasury Department, and it's a fee on tons of carbon emissions that are put into our air. And then that fee is returned to the American people in the form of a dividend payment to each American household, and it's 100% of the payments goes right back into the American people.
I understand that a new topic to bring this up, certainly it's been brought up here in the statewide level, but also, too, that we have some national champions for the idea, and one of them is one of our U.S. senators. Tell us how Mike Braun is interested in this campaign.
Fellow Wabash graduate, Senator Braun. He recently joined the Climate Caucus, the only conservative Republican to do that. And he's tipping the scales in the right direction for us, and we're just trying to follow in his footsteps. He's actually even commented on our campaign, and he's excited about it. And he says it's good to see young conservatives interested in having these conversations. And honestly, I think that's what it comes down to, right? It's opening the door, having the conversations, coming up with solutions from a conservative standpoint. And I think that recently Kevin McCarthy said that we're at the risk of losing an entire generation of young voters if we don't start talking about these issues. And so, like Mike Braun is doing, we're just trying to lead by example. So,
have you found that since the Republican Party on the national level has rejected the Democrats' proposal of what they're calling the Green New Deal, that all of this kind of gave it the impact that it needed to get this program accelerated?
It's something that we all say that we don't like the Green New Deal, but then when you ask somebody, okay, well, what's your plan to be able to combat that? Nobody really has an idea about that yet. And so, I mean, sure, would we love for our idea to be passed through and for carbon dividends to actually be launched in our government and things like that? Of course. But I think more importantly, we want to be able to start this conversation. And sure, if people have other ideas or want to add onto it or shift and pivot in other directions too, I mean, this is something that we need to start considering. And I think that we're seeing that if we sit on the sidelines here, something like a Green New Deal is going to be put in place, and we're not going to like it very much.
And we probably should mention that this is not a brand new idea for Republicans, that you mentioned that past presidential administrations have brought this up. In particular, you mentioned about the George H.W. Bush administration. What did President George H.W. Bush at the time propose, and how did that signal what needs to be done today?
He was doing more on the, I don't know if you remember, the acid rain types of things. And to be able to get rid of that, he implemented a similar program, I guess is how you would say it, but to be able to tax those things and get rid of it. And then you can also even look at Richard Nixon too, who arguably was the president that's done the most for climate change with the creation of the EPA and things of that nature. So, I mean, this is something that people forget that Republicans have been championing in the past, and it's something that we're going to continue to do in the future, and we're just trying to lay the groundwork for that.
I know you just recently announced the involvement of the Indiana College Republicans, in particular your colleagues there at Wabash College Republicans, to get involved in this national program. Have you got any feedback within Indiana yet about the idea since it's just been introduced?
Yeah, there has been a number of conservatives that have reached out to me, both nationally and also in the state, that are excited about this. And they said that this is something that they've been thinking about too, but didn't really have an opportunity to be able to express an opinion or to even think about an idea. And so they've reached out and have been supportive. But at the same time too, we've also had some pushback nationally. I'm just going to be completely honest with you. It's something that young conservatives across the country within our College Republicans framework are still trying to discuss and figure out where they stand on it, and we've had some pushback.
Really?
I think that's healthy, though. I mean, you don't want to just have everybody agree with each other all the time, right? We're starting these conversations and having some pushback. I think that's healthy, and it's going to only make our plan that much stronger.
Do you think that maybe this pushback, the opposition that you're getting from some of the groups is kind of indicative of this very partisan, hyper-partisan situation that we're in our country that we see?
I don't think it comes down to that. I think it comes down to the traditional conservative values that we've been instilled with from a very young age in our households. And this wasn't a conversation that had been being had. You know, this is something that's fairly new to, I think, a lot of very traditional conservative Republicans. And, our party's going to have to shift. I mean, it's inevitable. I mean, as we look forward into the future, I think that there are single-issue voters, and I think that this might be one of those issues. And if the Republican Party doesn't come up with a solution to this or start talking about this issue, I think we're at risk of losing a lot of people. So it's getting over the initial hurdle of having the conversation. I think climate change is a trigger word for a lot of Republicans right now. They think that it's opening the door to something like a Green New Deal, but we can come up with conservative solutions, and I think we've done just that.
Now, what is going to be the next step in this whole process now that you've got the campaign started? It, of course, it was started earlier by the other groups, but in turn, how Indiana's going to get involved?
Obviously, taking our message directly to Republican leaders, whether that be Senator Braun, definitely wanting to start the conversation with Senator Young as well. We have been reaching out to our congressional offices and just starting the conversation, presenting this idea to them, getting their feedback, their thoughts on it. I mean, we're tweaking and things like that at the same time, too. And then I think it's going to take more of a grassroots approach. I think this isn't something that's going to be top-down. This is something that we're going to have to start from the bottom up and to be able to start within our very own College Republican chapters. You know, just introducing this, having healthy discussions, and then taking the results of these discussions back to our groups and keep pushing out our message that way.
Well, Isaiah, thank you very much for spending time to talk about this concept of how the Indiana Federation of College Republicans is joining in with this national organization to in turn persuade Hoosiers as well as national Republicans to join in on this campaign for climate change. And we hope to hear back from you with more soon.
No worries. Thanks, Chris.
You're welcome. Isaiah Mears is the state chairman of the Indiana Federation of College Republicans, and he is also the chairman of the Wabash College Republicans at Wabash College in Crawfordsville. Cancer is the leading cause of death among Latinos, according to the CDC in Atlanta. Yet Latinos and other minority groups are underrepresented in cancer research. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Anna Caroline Caruso has a report on the efforts to change that.
In a small house in South Bend, a family is getting ready for the Christmas holiday. The tree is up and everyone is drinking something they call Christmas punch. They're laughing together. One of their friends, Magdalena Hernandez, asks if I like the punch.
I don't know if you tried before. This is a Christmas punch.
Sounds good. Thank you so much.
Hernandez is wearing a bright orange shirt with dark purple lipstick, and her brown hair is pinned on the top of her head. From her appearance and all the laughter, you'd never guess she has an advanced form of cancer in her bone marrow. It's not curable. She was diagnosed with multiple myeloma around this time in 2017.
Honestamente, nada.
As far as what I felt, honestly, I didn't feel anything. I just asked the doctor, just take away the pain that I'm feeling right now.
But she had symptoms for years before that, like fatigue, weakness in her legs, and sharp pain all over her body, she describes as more painful than labor. She went to the emergency room once before, and the doctor told her it was inflammation and cleared her to go back to work. 1 year later, she was diagnosed with cancer.
I told the doctor, pretty much gave him this history of what had happened since the previous year. And that's when he told me that I had cancer and that it was advanced and that I didn't have the care that I should have had.
She says part of the reason she waited so long to get help was because she didn't fully trust the American healthcare system. Hernandez's story is not uncommon. Susana Lagunas is a family nurse practitioner at a local clinic and is a Latina herself. She says she sees this all the time through her work.
Many Latinos are diagnosed, especially with cancer, at a later stage. So a more advanced disease at that point. So the burden of that is obviously mortality.
Laguna says there are many barriers that keep Latinos from seeking medical attention, like language. She used to translate for her family members when they first came to the U.S. Even though most clinics have translator services, she says sometimes it's over the phone, which can cause problems.
Every time I walk into a room and they looked at me and I look Latina, I speak Spanish, they will just like breathe in relief that somebody's there, that maybe I can be helpful and help them express their medical needs.
Lack of health insurance is a barrier too, one that caused big problems for Hernandez.
Volvemos a lo mismo.
It was very difficult for me to get the assistance here. There is help and there is assistance, but not for everyone.
Hernandez wasn't able to find help in South Bend because of her immigration status, so she has family members and friends drive her to Chicago once a week for treatment. Paul Beltran works at Indiana Health Center in South Bend. He also helped translate earlier for Hernandez. Beltran says Latinos who are new to the U.S. aren't always familiar with the healthcare system.
There's people who come from villages in their home countries where, you know, the doctor was a, they would call him the curandero, which is just a person, you know, who knows a thing or two about medicine, but it's really just very basic, you know, herbs and those kind of things.
He says the difference in cultures is just as big a barrier as language, insurance, and immigration status. In Latin American culture, it can be just as important to have a doctor that you connect with personally as it is to have a doctor that knows what they're doing. Hernandez says that relationship is hard to find.
Pienso que lo que dije antes.
But as far as the dignity and respect that they can provide is very, very scarce. It's very few. It almost feels like they wait till you're in your deathbed or dying to do what they really need to do to try to save you.
For Hernandez and others in the Latino community, these barriers have had serious repercussions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Anna Caroline Caruso.
Have you noticed more seniors are in the workforce these days? Well, that's a question that Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer has been asked often, and he was with us on Regionally Speaking not long ago to talk about the different retirement strategies that working seniors have to take.
Yeah, we do. And, you know, a lot of that, Chris, I think is a reflection of, you know, the fact that people are living longer, number one, so retirement has been stretched out from, you know, what used to be typically 10, 15 years to, you know, more of the 20, 25, even 30 years for a lot of people. And, you know, a lot of your benefits, even Social Security, are the full benefits are being pushed back later. And I think the result is you're seeing, the population begin to age that or before you begin retirement.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the tips that you can pass along to us and tell us about, if we're not aware of, to make sure that we are ready for retirement if we're at that age or approaching that age?
Well, I think first, the government's realizing that they need to do something to allow people to catch up, you know, to put more money towards retirement. And the catch-up provisions continue to increase within our normal retirement vehicles like the 401Ks and the IRAs. And those catch-up provisions have increased again this year. You know, for the 401K, you have your standard $19,000 for everybody, but the 50 and over can now contribute an additional $6,000 in contributions to the 401K. And the IRA has gone up to $6,000, and you have a catch-up provision of
$1,000. Mm-hmm. How about looking ahead for, I guess, if we haven't set up a strategy or taken advantage of the ones that are out there to be able to use our tax dollars the best?
Well, I think the biggest thing today is the new tax laws have really created some unique opportunities that just simply didn't exist prior to these tax laws, mm-hmm, in terms of which strategies would be the best. And with the tax implications and the rates being as low as they are, the non-taxable contributions like the Roth can be a lot more advantageous than they have been in the past and can help diversify those assets that are sitting in retirement.
And we talked about this before, of course, about trying to plan ahead and literally, in this case, creating an income plan if you don't have one, right?
Well, I think ultimately we've talked about this many times, Chris. It has to start with the end in mind. You know, it's a common phrase that people have heard, but it's kind of hard to get to where you want to go if you don't know exactly what it is you want in retirement or where it is you want to end up.
And, yeah.
And the income plan is first and foremost that map, you know, that guideline. Okay, where is it that I want to go? What are the things I can do? And then actively work on it to constantly improve that plan. and try to avoid costly mistakes, but, you know, give you a better idea of what the target is. What do I need to have set aside? What type of assets do I have to have? Where do they have to be in order to accomplish my goals?
Now, for folks that are in retirement or approaching retirement, and they are maybe trying to get things planned out as they can, but, of course, they're looking ahead to try and decide, well, do I really want to work? Do I want to officially retire, or do I want to continue to work into my retirement year, so to speak? But there's some things that you need to think about, and I know that there are three in particular that you bring up often. Let's bring those up, please.
Sure. I mean, the first thing is, you know, how you envision your retirement. And a lot of folks, they don't like idle time. You know, they've been active their entire careers. They've worked, you know, constantly and consistently their entire careers. And, you know, they feel like, you know, if I continue to work, it's just something that they would enjoy doing, something that they, you know, would feel fit in well with their retirement. But it's a second career, that it's something that they enjoy to do. And they have fun doing it, you know, and it adds the additional income.
Mm-hmm.
I think also, you know, part of it is, you know, most people, when they retire, we typically find that the first 5, 8, maybe 10 years of retirement generally are going to have a lot more bucket list items being accomplished, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so the nest egg might satisfy their retirement lifestyle, but even with the sizable nest egg, a lot of times they just want to, you know, add to that nest egg for some of the things that they like to do. The key is if you're going to do that, is whatever am I doing, does it give me the flexibility to still maintain, you know, what I see my retirement? So how you envision your retirement, is it solely focused on pastimes? Is it focused on grandkids? Is it focused on, you know, just hanging out and relaxing? Whatever it might be, you need to envision that structure that keeps you busy, and working in retirement may be a fit, you know, if you want a more active retirement.
Now, I suppose, too, for example, if you're a businessman and you've decided to step aside from the business or the industry that you happen to have been business in, but you still want to participate and help out with many organizations, in particular like those that are out there that help new businesses get started, get some of their problems resolved, because you have the experience you can put to it. You may not necessarily get paid, but you need to kind of plan ahead if you do want to be able to do that kind of volunteer work and still be able to pay for everything, right?
Absolutely. And, yeah. And again, we sound like a broken record sometimes, but it always goes back to, you know, what's my plan? You know, yeah. Not only the income plan, that income plan really needs to incorporate, you know, how do I envision my retirement? What do I see it as? You know, what are the things I want to do? How do I want to spend my time? You know, we've done what we had to up to that point. Now it's more or less, you know, what do I want to do? And there's a big difference, I tell people, between having and wanting, right? If I want to do some things and maybe I have some passions, I have a lot of friends that have gone through their career, and they might have a charitable interest in mind to say, hey, my passion in retirement, and I want to stay active. I want to figure out how to, you know, create this type of fundraising for this particular organization, or I want to spend time, you know, working in this personal arena because it's something I've always wanted to do, but it couldn't support what I needed to have, you know, during my working years.
That's Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. For veterans, the Appeals Modernization Act that passed last year, it's kicked off a much-needed change in the veteran benefit appeals process, and the VA is trying to transform the appeals process to make it quicker and make it more efficient for those that are seeking appeals, and can also keep up with the growing pace of appeals as well as number. We have with us Dave McClanahan, who's the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, to talk about it. Dave, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me. This is very important information for your listeners in the Chicagoland area, and I guess Indiana as well.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of veterans live in the area.
Well, we do, because the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center out of Chicago and its accompanying outpatient clinics include Indiana. In fact, there's one just about 2 miles away from our studios, as a matter of fact, in Crown Point. So we're close by, and a lot of veterans, even for those who live to the east of us directly, are being helped as well, too, even though they may, because of their distance, they may be taking advantage of the service that allows them to be able to see a local practitioner or a local healthcare provider, if need be, for their services here. But there's a new law, I understand, of course, dealing with the veteran benefit appeals process. And tell us first what the problems seem to be.
Generally, what we're talking about here is veterans that have a disability compensation claim.
Mm-hmm.
That's the vast majority of our appeals. It's about 95% of all appeals. So it's generally not a healthcare claim. It's more of a monetary benefit claim for veterans that have service-connected disability.
Yeah.
And so as far as the issue of why there are so many appeals, you can really look back for several decades, and the appeal rate has always been relatively the same, about 11 to 12% of all decisions that are made. So what happened is as we increased our claim processing to where we are now deciding every year well over a million claims, you're always going to get that 11 to 12% appeal, and the current system is simply not built to handle that kind of burden. So it was really a process that developed over a long, long time, and it just is not serving veterans well now. And I think we all came to an agreement that we needed to design something new.
Does it seem like that it's turned out that the old process that is being updated by the new law was just too cumbersome, I guess, too complicated maybe?
Yes, I think that's it's too complex, too slow. And I don't know if your listener is aware of this, but on average, it's taken about 3 to 7 years for veterans to get a resolution of their appeal in the current process. So we were essentially just falling further and further behind. And that's simply because of the nature of the system that was provided to us in our legislation, which kept the record on the appeal open throughout the appeal so veterans could file additional information. We'd have to re-adjudicate the claim. And we also have a continuing duty to assist throughout the process. So, again, we just needed to pull it apart and redesign it, and that's what's in this new law that the president signed about a year ago now.
Now, what are the three appeals review options that veterans have if they don't happen to agree with the initial claims decisions?
Right, so that's one of the key features of the new law is it gives veterans choice, something that they don't have now. So, for example, if they have some additional evidence and they want VA to continue to help them develop their claim, they can file a supplemental claim, and we'll process that just like we do initial claims in about an average of 125 days. Secondly, if they believe that there was an error made in the prior decision, they can ask for a higher-level review by a more experienced employee, and that higher-level reviewer will look at the evidence that was before the prior decision-maker and see if he or she can make a different decision or identify an error. And again, we'll process those. Our goal is an average of 125 days. And then finally, veterans that want to appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals can appeal directly to the board in lieu of going through the Veterans Benefits Administration, for example. That's something that's not available under current law. Allows them to get an immediate review by a veterans law judge. And the goal there is to do those more formal appeals in an average of about 1 year if the veteran selects the fastest route at the board.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we should mention, too, that as a result of the new law that's in effect, there's what's called RAMP, which is what this program's called, the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program. Who is eligible for this program? And you've talked about some of the advantages. I'm sure there are probably plenty of them.
Right. We wanted to demonstrate our commitment to veterans that currently have appeals pending. So in your listening area, that's about 18,000 veterans that have an appeal pending right now.
Mm-hmm.
And because their appeal is already pending, the law that goes into effect in February isn't going to help them right away. They're already in this appeal process we have now. What we're doing is we're allowing them through this RAMP program to opt into the new system. They can do that now. All they have to do is file one of those supplemental claims or ask for a higher-level review. And the good news is that there's already about 50,000 veterans that are participating in this program, and they're getting decisions within that 125-day goal that we've set. And we've already paid more than $50 million in retroactive benefits. So the program is working for veterans. We just need help with people such as you to get the word out to veterans to use this program.
We're talking with Dave McClenahan, who is the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, about this new program passed last year in law by Congress and signed by the president on the Veterans Benefit Appeals process. Now, what would happen to a pending appeal if a veteran should decide not to participate in this in RAMP, this new program?
All right. So RAMP is voluntary. We can't force veterans to use it. It's better for them if they do use it, but it is voluntary. So a veteran can choose to stay in the current process, and the vast majority of our resources are on those legacy appeals. We'll continue to work them, and it's our goal to work them down as quickly as we can. But there are inherent delays in the current process. Everybody agrees to that, and that's why the new law was enacted. But we will continue to work those appeals if veterans choose to stay in that process. Mm-hmm.
Now, since this is a new program, how can veterans make a decision on which of the ramp options might work best for them?
Well, first of all, we always recommend that they consult with their representative if they have one and ask about which choice they should make. But I would like to point out that another key feature of the new system is that veterans really can't make a mistake in choosing an option.
Oh.
What I mean by that is that once they choose one of those two options, supplemental claim or higher level review, and they get a decision, the other options are still available. There's never a penalty that affects the veteran's date that their benefits will start. So that's also good news for veterans. You can't really make a mistake in the new process.
Now, if people are interested, if veterans in particular and family members that we've been listening to this are interested, where can they go if they do have questions about their appeals or maybe some assistance?
Right. So other than talking to their representative,
yeah,
there is a lot of information that's available on our website, benefits.va.gov. That includes information on the RAMP program and other initiatives that we have going, and they can find the RAMP election document online that they can send to us to get into the RAMP program.
Well, David, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain this new program. This seems to be, appeals reform seems to be one of the biggest changes that we've seen come out of the Department of Veterans Affairs in quite some time, and we're glad to see this new program get pushed in and put on fast track, I guess, to put into effect. Thank you for being with us to explain it for us today.
You're welcome. This is one of our highest priorities, and we're looking forward to implementing the law in February.
David McClanahan is the director of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Appeals Management Office. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.